Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. If you're just joining us, we're listening to a Constitution Day panel from Manchester University. Dr. Leonard Williams will ask the next question in a moment, and Michael Stoudemire, Assistant Professor of History, will be the first to answer. Enjoy.
Why should anyone come into a room like this and be subjected to talk about a document that they have little or no relationship to, or that they may even be antagonistic to, for the reasons you've highlighted?
I'll be very brief on this because I think I went on a little long with my previous answer. I think it's precisely because I have an antagonistic relationship with the Constitution that I feel it's really crucial that I understand what it says. That's an essential piece of how you, again, if history is an argument, an essential piece of how you develop arguments is you take the best possible interpretations of your opponent's position and then you respond to them, right? So it's very important in my personal efforts that I have a deep and clear understanding of the Constitution, and I encourage that in everybody. I think it's incumbent on all of us if we are going to, again, strive for a democratic society. We all need to understand what is the framework under which we're operating and what's good about it if there are good things and what's bad about it when there are bad things.
I definitely agree with that. And also the fact that we can still have amendments that state policy can really go around. So we think of the 13th Amendment that, you know, abolished slavery, but we still had sharecropping. And my grandparents were sharecroppers. They sharecropped land for over 24 years and was promised the land and would never received it. And that often happened with sharecroppers. It was a very unjust system that just furthered subjugation of people of color when it came to the trade industry and the labor industry. We think of voting and voting rights. We know that there were poll taxes and literacy tests when it came to people of color. And still to this day, there are issues with different counties and different areas that are taking away polls in areas that are multiple minoritized. And that is a way to get around the system. So we know that we need to really understand the Constitution and really be able to interrogate it, because there's still ways to subjugate populations and there's still ways to get around it through policies that we still need to advocate for lived experiences and lives of individuals, because if we don't, then we're just headed down a bad path when it comes to injustice.
Just to kind of be contrarian, I'm going to say some positive things. One thing that strikes me that is worth saying is that living under a constitution is a tremendous civilizational achievement. The fact that we have rule of law to even the extent that we do, and the fact that people in a country can be so committed to things like freedom of speech and freedom of religion, even acknowledging all the ways in which those values can be misused or warped, or that we fail to achieve those values, it's so easy to not have those things, to not have rule of law, to not have constitutionalism, to have arbitrary power to an even greater extent than we do. So one reason to care about it is just to realize that we have this tool that we often don't even register in our lives, that like there are certain things that can't be done to you. It can't be done to you because of your identity. It can't be done to you because of your class status. Now again, have we delivered that promise? Absolutely not. But the fact that there's a common sense that we ought to be at least aiming at that is something that a constitution gives us. Now, I want to fully endorse a lot of the worries about our particular constitution being undemocratic. I basically completely agree with that. But I think that we should have both of those things in mind. Like one reason to care about it is that it can be enabling, and it can be protective, and it can be supportive of real positive change. Now, are there headwinds against that? Absolutely. But I think that one reason to care about it is because if you learn how to use it, you can build on the things that people have done with the Constitution, which have been positive, and potentially chip away at some of the things that people have raised concerns about.
Yeah, I certainly agree with all of that. We should care because laws and policies are enacted on a regular basis. based on interpretations of the Constitution. And so again, in our discussion about the composition of the Supreme Court, that matters. And again, one of the things that Mike had noted with regard to the Senate being undemocratic, that there will be a time when the majority of populations of our population are going to be clustered into just a few states, leaving a broad swath of the country who are overrepresented, if you will, in the Senate. And it's senators who decide who it is who sits on the court. And as I've indicated, the Constitution expands rights, such as the right to marry someone of the same sex, as I mentioned before. But it also has narrowed rights, particularly those around voting, those around financial contributions to political campaigns and the like. So those certainly are concerns. So I do want to take just a tiny detour from this, and I talk about the Constitution in the pharmacy law course that I teach in the pharmacy program. And I explain to my students that even as pharmacists, the Constitution impacts what it is we can and cannot do as pharmacists. For example, the First Amendment, as you know, applies to speech and freedom of speech, but it also applies to commercial speech. And commercial speech involving the sale of goods and services. And so, and how that applies in pharmacy, for example, is with regard to labeling of drug products and the kinds of things that can be included in the drug product labeling. And also talking about things that are not on the label can be a violation of the First Amendment and violation of federal law. So I do tie in the Constitution even in my discussion with pharmacy students because it is pervasive. It provides that framework for how we interact with society, but also it really does drive and dictate a lot of what we are able to do as professionals as well.
One thing that comes through is that you've thought about the Constitution, I think, more than just for tonight. You've spent time thinking about American politics, international politics, society, power, all of those really basic concepts. So I'm wondering, given that you spent so much time thinking about this, when you do think about the Constitution, what kinds of misconceptions have you heard from people that you might have encountered, say, with students or colleagues or friends? What things have you heard that really betray some basic misunderstanding of the document and its role in American politics?
Well, for me, there is a misconception that the Constitution established a democracy in the United States. The Constitution established a republic. A democracy, in general terms, is a government by the majority of the people. A republic, in general terms, added safeguards like checks and balances to ensure a representative government that guarantees individual rights. And so there is a difference, albeit subtle. But the words have become somewhat interchangeable over the years, and so that, I think that's a myth of the Constitution.
I think that the misconception that I encounter the most has to do with the viewpoint originalism. So a lot of people have the sense that if you're interpreting the Constitution, you should do it according to the original intent behind the people that wrote it, or according to the original meaning of the document at the time it was written. There's a lot of problems with that view that I think people don't realize. I'll just mention a couple. And again, the reason why I bring this up is because a lot of people see this as very intuitive and obvious, and in fact, as a litmus test to whether someone's a good judge or not, and I think that that's fairly implausible when you think about it. So for one, the idea that intent would be the basis for how we should interpret the Constitution, there's just a really hard sort of barrier to trying to figure out what anyone's intentions are when they write a document. And if you look at Scalia, Justice Scalia, who recently passed away, who's a very influential jurist, who was also an originalist, he in fact rejected the idea that original intent should play the role in how we interpret the Constitution. And in part because there's an implausibility, like what's the intention of a legislature passing a law? Well, there's lots of different people with lots of different intentions. How that relates to the law itself is hard to say. So then they move to the idea that maybe the meaning of a document is what we should be looking at. So if we want to know what the word reasonable means, we should get a dictionary from the 1700s and see what it says. Think about today, if you were to ask people in this room what reasonable meant, you'd get a lot of different views. If you were to ask people in this room what freedom or liberty meant, you'd get a lot of different answers. So the idea that you could find some singular meaning from the time in which the document was written is actually quite implausible, I would argue. But people seem to still think it's intuitive. So I think that if that's the case, we need to think harder about how to interpret the document, because originalism is not really going to do the job for us.
You know, my background is diversity, equity, and inclusion work. I used to be an administrator at Kenyon College, and it still really integrates within my work right now. So I really think two big misconceptions is around freedom of speech and definitely the freedom of assembly and petition, which is First Amendment rights. I'm pretty sure you all have read the Bill of Rights. But I often have conversations with people, especially online. I'm sometimes berated online about, some of my articles that I post. And I'm a millennial. And I think millennials are often stereotyped as like the delete and block population of society, that if you don't like something, you just delete and block. I actually like to have individuals on my Facebook and in my circle that disagree with me. I grew up with old school grandparents who were vastly different than I am. So I really enjoy that. But when it comes to the freedom of speech, that is something that is often the topic, that someone can call me a arrogant, or someone can call me a f***, or someone can call me different names. And that is a freedom that they have to say certain things like that. And that's a freedom that makes up who they are, because that's something that their mother said, or their grandparents said, or that's something that is passed down from family back when. But when we have to think that our traditions require the subserviency and also the degradation of certain populations, then we really need to start rethinking our traditions. But more specifically within the freedom of speech, there's limits to freedom of speech. There's limits, especially if it prevents people from having life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and if it prevents people from having, not necessarily within the safe space that we often see and often are often critical about, but when it comes to the safety of an individual. And those words are hate speech that prevent community to be developed. And although it may be a tradition passed down from different generations to generation, we really need to start interrogating, the role that speech has when it comes to people prospering or not and our place within it. So I think that's one misconception that I often hear.
I really like what all three of my colleagues just offered up in terms of misconceptions. I'm going to offer one that's maybe more narrow or specific. Today is the one-year anniversary of the day that Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. And not only is my research largely about the Puerto Rican diaspora, so Puerto Ricans living in the mainland U.S., but I also have a 25-year-long connection to the Puerto Rican community in Chicago in particular. And so that was a really traumatic day for lots and lots of my very good friends. One thing that emerged in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria was a lot of polling. And one of the polling questions was, whether or not you were aware that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. And more than 50% of Americans polled in the mainland did not know that Puerto Ricans were U.S. citizens. So that's one layer. But then there's another layer on top of that, which is why and how are Puerto Rican citizens? And the answer is, it's not because of the Constitution. The Constitution and Supreme Court rulings from about 110 years ago determined that Puerto Ricans do not have, under the Constitution, any specific rights. They have to be granted by Congress if they're going to obtain rights. And so Puerto Ricans eventually, through a series of acts of Congress, became U.S. citizens. But that means that an act of Congress is sufficient to strip something like 4 to 5 million people of U.S. citizenship. I don't predict it. I don't think it's likely to happen. But the fact that we think of citizenship as something that is guaranteed by the Constitution, when in fact millions of citizens don't have their citizenship guaranteed by the Constitution, that's something that I think we ought to be attentive to. And that basically points in the direction of what I would argue, again, history is an argument, the history of Puerto Rico's relationship to the United States since 1898, when the U.S. took control of it, is that of a colony. And we don't normally like to think of the United States as having colonies, but Puerto Rico is a colony, plain and simple. And that is, I would say, related to that question of misconceptions about citizenship. So I'll leave it at that.
How might we repair this Constitution? A number of you have talked about the value of having a document that gets amended from time to time, that can be updated and improved. If you were in a position to make changes, what changes would you make? And why? Always the why question.
I think it's a challenging question that you've asked. There have been a very limited number of amendments to the Constitution. That's amending the Constitution certainly, and this is not hyperbolic, it takes an act of Congress. It really is unlikely that that certain rights that we have enjoyed will be enumerated in as an amendment to the Constitution. For example, you know, and certainly this is just my opinion, but I believe that as citizens of the United States, that we have a right to quality health care. And that's certainly not something that's going to be enumerated anytime soon in the Constitution. And so it's challenging in thinking about how do we fix it. I don't know, other than thinking about how do we fix the system. Because again, so much of the rights that we enjoy under the Constitution are because of federal court interpretation of the Constitution. And so we have a broken process right now of appointing federal judges to the bench. We have a broken process playing out before our very eyes with regard to the confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh. And as it was mentioned, appointment to the Supreme Court, it's lifetime. And so if a court is stacked, if you will, through gamesmanship, like we have seen in the last few years by Congress, those decisions coming out of the court can have long-lasting effects that could live with us for an entire generation. In listening to some of the hearings involving Judge Kavanaugh, he was asked a question about unenumerated rights, and I talked about that a little bit ago, about those rights that aren't specifically stated in the Constitution and the fragility of them. And in his questioning, Judge Kavanaugh invoked what is known as the Glucksberg test. And Glucksberg was a case some 20 years ago involving whether or not citizens have the right to hasten their own death in order to die with dignity. And it was determined that that was not a right in the Constitution. Since that case, judges have used the holding in Glucksberg, which they call the Glucksberg test, and applied it to unenumerated rights, and have indicated that only those unenumerated rights that are rooted in history and tradition should stand. And that's one of the things that has proponents of women's reproductive rights concerned, because Roe versus Wade was pre-Glucksberg, and that case certainly wasn't decided on those grounds. And so we have to fix the system, I think, before we can fix the Constitution.
I think the main thing, I'll mention two things, I guess. The main thing I would focus on is the way the Constitution was built with the expectation that we would live in an economically equal society, in part because the expectation that the founders had was that the class of citizens would be restricted. So, you know, they were expecting only people of a certain race and class to be, and gender, to be citizens. And so there was less of a concern that there would be economic inequality within that group of people. Citizenship has expanded, and economic inequality has also expanded. So the question is, how can a system function with that level of economic inequality when it wasn't designed to do that? I'm not sure exactly what to do about that. I think a lot of the solutions are not constitutional, but are systemic and policy-based, like Tommy was suggesting. But I do think that it's worth thinking about whether there should be constitutional rights to basic goods, like health, education, housing, those general kinds of things that you need to survive. That's not going to necessarily narrow inequality, but it might at least provide a basis for citizenship that's stronger than we have now. The other thing I would mention is most of you are probably aware that you have a right to counsel if you're charged in a criminal case in general. So if you get arrested, charged with a crime, you get read your Miranda rights. Part of what you're supposed to get is a public defender if you can't afford your own attorney. So that's not true if you're getting a divorce or if you get sued by somebody else over, you know, really core property that you own. It's not true if you are in a housing dispute with your landlord. It's not true if you're in debt. So that means that you could be in a situation where you're under a civil suit or dealing with a civil suit, and the other side has an attorney and you can't afford one. That strikes me as not a good way to run a justice system, where you have such an unequal basis for both parties. So there's a movement for something called civil Gideon. Gideon is a decision that relates to the right to counsel in criminal cases. So there's an argument that in any situation where your fundamental goods and rights and liberties are at stake, whether it's a criminal or a civil case, you should have representation. And I think that if that were in the Constitution, that would really help a lot with some pretty important situations that people find themselves in, related to things like housing, marriage, and so on.
I definitely agree. You know, especially about fixing the system. You know, the Constitution and our fabric of our nation was developed to protect white hetero male supremacy. I'm just going to put it all the way out there. I'm going to label it and name it, because no one's labeled it and named it yet. And it really, that was the fabric of it. So when we talk about how there were not protected classes, or we did not think of other classes and groups of individuals having citizenship, it's because the Constitution was developed to protect white, hetero, male supremacy. Even when you think of affirmative action, and that is often very contested, that's often a very angry topic, but even affirmative action was built to even protect white females, because that is one of the greatest populations that have benefited from affirmative action. It was a compromise. It was a compromise for making sure that people of color and diverse backgrounds also had protections when it comes to employment, and had a fair and equitable treatment when it came to employment and getting opportunities. But more importantly as well, white women in America are protected by affirmative action. So when we think of that, that means we really need to think and interrogate the Constitution in a way that is diversity, equity, and inclusion lens. And that means that we need to think of other people that are citizens in our nation that have different lived experiences, we need to also look at the foundation of our United States and how the Constitution was created and who is being left out from the narrative and their lived experiences as well. And also be able to comfortably talk about these things, because by the fact that I named it as the document protecting white hetero male supremacy is an uncomfortable label to situate yourself, especially if you're not comfortable talking about diversity, equity, inclusion topics. But I want it to be uncomfortable. And that is something that is not really, you know, doesn't really jive well, especially with millennials and younger sometime, and even older, that talking about these topics is normal. I want you to feel uncomfortable, because if you're not in a comfortable situation about these, then you're not going to be able to interrogate the system to change it, whether you agree or disagree with what I'm saying. So that is my way, and at least my idea of fixing the system, is being able to interrogate the Constitution and really see that by me being a little judgmental about the Constitution in the United States as well, doesn't mean that I lack pride as a citizen, because we know that when we interrogate, when we want to fix a system, that also means that me as a citizen, I have value in it. I'm not going to put a lot of emphasis in changing something if I didn't care. Exactly, right? So that means that we need to also care about other peoples within this United States of America too, and how they fit within it too.
Well, I have already offered at least one example of what, you know, small change might look like. As a historian, I'm also really interested in how changes get made to the Constitution, because you can look at it in this sort of very formalistic way, right? The Congress has to pass, and then a certain number of states have to ratify. That's not, in my estimation, really how some of the more valuable pieces of the constitutional amendments in particular end up getting passed, right? So people have already talked about the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery. The 14th and 15th come shortly after. We've talked about the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage. I would even, regardless of how you feel about it, put in the 20th Amendment that establishes prohibition. Those are all amendments that resulted from popular upsurges from below that couldn't be ignored by the people in positions of power in the United States, whether that be in Congress or in state legislatures. And all of those, I think, provide us with a template for how we are likely to bring about any productive change. It is far more efficacious to push for grassroots social movements that can change society than, in my estimation at least, to tinker around the edges with the sort of formalistic process.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Matt Unger and his team at Manchester University for providing the audio for this program. Next week, we will dive deeper into the issue of elections, and our music is by Mark Waldick. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.